The start of the week and loads on the radio, from the easing of some restrictions and coping with the idea of getting back to normal to the continuing conversation on the menopause. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
So I'm in very capable hands, looking forward to the colour, as you can see, get rid of all the greys. And a good cut, and I'll be $1 million.
Basically, my story is in my late 30s, I had to have a hysterectomy because we had 13 miscarriages. And
oh my God, sorry, Anne, 13 miscarriages.
Yeah.
We're still standing at the gates and we're still begging like children. We're begging for 976 babies to be taken out of a septic tank in June.
And in the morning, a bit of hope and optimism in the air with the easing of some restrictions. First up, Ryan Tuberty was looking forward to new hair and a trip to the museum. Me too, Ryan. Me too.
It's going to be a little wet, windy and rainy around the place today, but that's okay because you can go to the library, you can go to the museum, you can visit the gallery, you can go to your barber, you can go to your hairdresser, you can click and you can collect your way through relative liberty and freedom this morning, because a long, cold, dark winter is over and we are now into a different game altogether. And this is not like before. This is not like when they lifted the restrictions. To be careful, obviously we have to be careful, but it wasn't like Christmas where there were no vaccines, and it was just this time the number of people, the older people vaccinated, the underlying illness people vaccinated, the frontline workers vaccinated. This is makes it a totally different ballgame. And as we've been hearing all morning, more vaccinations coming down the line. So this is, as we tread carefully but very much confidently into the future, this is a good news day. It is a good Monday for most people this morning. And I suspect people who are lifting the shutters physically for the first time today will be a little nervous about it all, and that's understandable, but be excited too, because hopefully people will be out and about spending their money and kind of getting the economy kick-started again. Even listening to them talking this morning about being able to go into a library, I miss a browse. I'm not talking about the browse in my head. I'm talking about going into the shop, and particularly bookshop or the library, and just seeing all those gorgeous spines of the books and the stories come to life, and thinking, yeah, I need that back in the world, and museums and galleries. And be careful, by the way, if you are thinking of going to particularly one of the bigger galleries and museums, do look them up online before, in case you need to maybe get yourself an e-ticket. I noticed that yesterday, that you may need to book yourself an e-ticket to, rather than landing in cold, just watch that one if you're going to any of the national, particularly the national libraries or galleries today. Keep an eye on that. And cross-county travel, they mentioned a good point in the AA Roadwatch this morning, which was that because I certainly haven't been across the border, the Dublin border, at all since we were told not to. And they're saying that when you drive into towns or villages that you're familiar with, because of different markings on the road, things will be a little different. So just prepared for kind of stranger days and travels and directions in places you might be going to. But if you are going, enjoy yourself and safe travels, and wish you well. And just essentially good luck to everybody today who are maybe visiting or hugging or doing whatever they can do. All these vaccinated people that can do all the good things. Everyone else has to be a little more careful, but that's okay, because it'll all come out good in the end. So good luck, bonne chance, and have fun while you're getting there.
Well, that's Ryan there. And then on Today with Claire Byrne, Brian O'Connell was in an actual hairdresser's in Cork.
Brian, you must think we're so busy here that we haven't time to look at Instagram, but I did see you at 8:30 this morning with your head in a basin.
That was the before pic, I have to say, Claire, just in the case you think I'd got my hair done. I'm here in Soby Brown Salon. It's on Morrison's Quay in the centre of Cork City Centre. And today really is the day people have been waiting for 5 months. From 8:30 this morning, customers began arriving for appointments. I can tell you, if you walked in off the street today looking for a new appointment, you're looking at a wait of 6 weeks. They're that busy in advance. I suppose the difference with reopening now is that each customer has to have an appointment. So really, you simply can't walk in to your local barber or hairdresser and be seen on spec. And then all the other health measures, Claire, are in place here. Some hairdressers, including the one here, will take your temperature when you arrive. Obviously, you have to sanitize your hands, wear a mask. And then all the fabrics being used are being washed, I'm told, at 60 degrees. And then the screens and there's different areas segregated within the salon here to separate customers.
OK, so tell us about the lucky ones then, Brian, the ones who are first in the door this morning.
I'd say you're so jealous, are you?
Just a bit.
Just after 8:30, there was one or two people waiting when the doors were opened, and they'd been waiting for 5 months, of course. They got their temperature checked on arrival. They're in different parts of the salon now, and we can hear from some of them.
I'm delighted to be here. It's a long time coming.
So the last time you had a haircut?
That was December.
December.
How's her hair looking? Has she been at the DIY home?
She has, but you know what? People have had to do what they've had to do. Our hair is our armour. You haven't done a bad job. So it's not...
Don't be telling her that. She might not come back.
Well, you know what? I think the experience is sometimes what people are here for as well, isn't it? More than anything.
Completely. I'm our own family hairdresser. I have to cut all the boys' hair and my daughter's hair. But, you know, it's not the same when you're doing it yourself. Yeah.
So what's the plan this morning?
We're just going to make over.
Tell me, you were looking forward to today, obviously.
I couldn't wait.
Really?
Couldn't wait. And when Katie rang me, it was like winning the lottery to get the first phone call. Yeah, it's great. I'm getting a colour, highlights, and a great cut and treatments.
We're all waiting for lots of different things.
Yeah.
We're waiting to meet our parents and our grandparents and so on. But this is just one little example of hope, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And this morning, hearing the country opening up again, it is another bit of hope. In the bigger picture, there is bigger problems besides our hair. You know what I mean? So coming back, it's a lovely treat and it's a great luxury, but I think getting more vaccinated and getting up and going again is our main priority.
I'm one of the first customers in this morning, delighted.
What have the last few months been like for you?
Very mixed, to be honest. My husband is a publican, so I've had the turbulence of him being off from his lifestyle. For me, I'm involved in the manufacturing industry, and supply to the manufacturing industry, so it's been extremely busy in certain industries. We adapted to the change and we adapted quite effectively, to be honest.
Even though there's a bit of normality today, obviously for your husband, he's not back to work yet.
But he's getting ready to get back to work, and there's a lot of excitement now. There's a lot of excitement on social media. There's a lot of excitement getting the outdoor areas ready. And even, you know, coming up to the city this morning, I said, seeing people are out and about, queuing for pennies, queuing for shops to get in, to get their slots. It's exciting. And how about yourself?
My hair, is it?
Yeah.
Is that a hint?
Yeah, it's lovely. Looking very natural, I have to say. That's what I enjoyed. No, it's lovely. Go natural. Go natural. That's it.
Oh, the envy, and my Wurzel Gummidge hair will have to wait another day. Later, Claire also spoke to Father Joe MacDonald of Strafan Parish about religious services opening for attendance.
Oh, sure, listen, it's great. I mean, the word joy has been used a few times, and that's very much weird. Not actually open until tomorrow when the church is open. We don't celebrate Mass on a Monday here. This is our day of reflection when we sort of try and reflect on what happened yesterday, the Sunday liturgy, the highlight of the week. So tomorrow we'll have two Masses in two beautiful churches. And it's great. It's a joyous occasion, Claire, where, you know, we have done our best with online, but like Mass was never meant to be celebrated, virtually. So great to be gathered, and I have to say there was a few times walking onto the altar in St. Patrick's with a closed church and nobody there. There was a sadness about that at times.
Yeah, and I'm sure as well, in thinking about it, your experience of having people in the church was centred around funerals, I would imagine, in the main.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the whole thing about the sacrament, you see, is that it brings you into the high points and the low points of people's lives. That's why they're as relevant as they are. So we missed out on the joy of baptizing the little baby, and of course the couples, you know, listening to the bridal shop there as well. I mean, the couples who had to postpone weddings sometimes, Claire, believe it or not once or twice, but three times, you know, so you can imagine what that was like.
Yeah, very difficult.
But the real heartbreak, of course, is, you know, the funeral. And you know, again, I don't want to be slipping into politicizing it, but to be honest, Claire, like 10 people, you know, allowed in a big church, you know, it was just, it was probably the hardest part of it, you know, because people were heartbroken enough without that, you know.
This is it. Well, now you'll be up to 50, which I know for some people, you know, big families will be very difficult. But look, it's an improvement on where you were. Do you think people will be willing to go into church now? Some people might feel very anxious about it. We'll be talking a bit more about this later on in the programme. But do you think people are ready to go back?
Oh, there's no doubt, Claire. It's not as simple as that, you know. I mean, there are people who I think probably won't come back. We may have lost people during the pandemic. Then there are people who will come back, but it's going to take time. They are anxious and they're going to go slowly, and you wouldn't blame them for that. They'll watch it and they'll, you know, they'll come back in their own time.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, I mean, I think that's a bigger challenge for us. I mean, I'm you know, today's excitement is great and the joy of it, but the bigger joy for us is that we have an Archbishop now. A new Archbishop, Dermot Farrell, and he has given us great hope and excitement because he set up a task force which is going to really move us forward into a new reality. Because this phrase, you know, we're not going back. I hope we don't go back to where we were. We want to try and, you know, build something different, Claire. And that will be, you know, trying to reach people who have never come, people who have gone away for various reasons, sometimes for really good reasons. And, of course, we'll try and look after the regular as well. But if we only concentrate on the regular, we'll be in trouble because, obviously, you know, that's a small group.
And for now, you have to limit your attendances to 50 people, and you have an app on your website so people can book in.
That's right. We have an app on the website called Book a Pew. It's not just new, because we had it for the previous, period of restriction as well. And yeah, by and large, it's working well, Claire. I mean, it's a challenge. I mean, whoever thought it'd be in a situation where you'd be booking your seat at Mass? You know, it sounds a bit crazy, but
yeah. But at the weekends, I would imagine it's going to be a challenge.
Yeah, it's not such a big challenge during the week generally. It works okay, but the big challenge is the weekend. Yeah, that's the difficulty. And you're trying to say to people, look, you know, if one of the things we'd be saying to people, instead of getting caught and saying, I have to be at Mass every day, to go once a week, or, you know, and try and give other people a chance and stuff like that. But that's the real challenge. And I mean, we hope that this is the beginning of a gradual, bigger opening up.
Father Joe MacDonald there on Today with Claire Byrne. And in the afternoon, Brian Dobson was also talking about the easing of restrictions.
Across the country, the shutters have been lifted, the shelves dusted down, and plans made to visit family and friends. In a moment, we'll hear from some of those looking forward to long-delayed family visits, and we'll talk to the Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Houlihan, about how the remainder of 2021 might look. But first, our reporter Sinead Spain has been out and about in Dunboyne in County Meath this morning. Sinead, how has the easing of restrictions been going there?
Well, Brian, a giddy air, I would say, in Dunboyne and County Meath this morning. Many of your listeners might be familiar with the place. It's a village on the Meath-Dublin border, and it has a large commuter hinterland. And I was out and about in Dunboyne this morning, and the first person I spoke to was at Dunboyne Hair and Beauty, Eva Hetherington, and her first customers in a long time.
Oh, great. It's great excitement today. Closed 19 weeks, so it's just fantastic to be back open and back in business.
And I presume you're out the door with clients.
Out the door today, yeah. We are fully booked, which is brilliant. It was such a worry, you know, it will be busy, won't we be busy, but we are busy and it's fantastic, yeah.
How many people will you have through the doors today, do you reckon?
Oh God, I'd say it could be at least 40 or 50 today because it's a long, we're here till late tonight, yeah. Which is great. And all our girls are here, there's 9 staff, so it's great we're all here today.
Yeah. I presume the phones were hopping the last week or so.
Oh, it has not stopped yet. It's great. All our customers are ringing now, booking their appointments in. But it's been a busy week coming up to this week, yeah.
How many hair disasters have you had from the home dyes?
Oh, well, so far so good now today by looking at the clients. But we've a long week ahead of us, yes.
Hi, Elaine. So you're here today. You're one of the first customers in Dunboyne.
That's right. Really excited to be here. Absolutely. Place looks great and everyone is so friendly and feel very comfortable as well in terms of just safety and the precautions and that. And there's a lovely community feel about the place. And
talk to me about the hair situation.
Well, as you can see, you know, this is the before. If you come back in a few hours, it'll be the after. But Lorna here has done my hair for nearly as long
you know, as the place has been open. So I'm in very capable hands, looking forward to the colour, as you can see, get rid of all the greys and a good cut, and I'll be $1 million.
Ah, Sinead Spain's report from the News at 1. Then Brian Dobson spoke to Chief Medical Officer Tony Houlihan.
The restrictions changing today, people are going to be able to avail of many of those, and your package there has shown very clearly what that means to people. It's also showing to me that the message is getting through. What came through to me in listening to so many of those reports is that people are picking up the message about caution. So we can do things, but we don't need to get ahead of where we are. And I think that's our key message now. We need to stay focused on May and the measures that were now being reintroduced, where there's a strong emphasis on outdoor activity. There's a strong emphasis on meeting up where it's safe, maintaining all the public health measures that are in place. And then obviously an opportunity for people who've been vaccinated, who some of the elderly people that you heard from there, who've spent much of the last 12 months following public health guidance, staying at home, staying away from loved ones and family members, being able to get out and about now and enjoy the benefits of that vaccination.
What do you say, particularly perhaps to older people, maybe those who are in a category where they're described as vulnerable, they maybe have some illnesses, and they have been really isolating themselves for the last year or more. The pressures, obviously, of coping with that over 12 months or more, but also maybe that they are concerned, hesitant about now beginning to come out and meet people again.
And of course, that would be very understandable. People will feel, on the one hand, that their confidence in terms of how they are physically, as well as the confidence in, if you like, how safe it is, that will take time to return. But I would really encourage people who've been vaccinated and who've gotten to the point of the benefits of that vaccine, where sufficient time has elapsed since their vaccine, to get out and about now, to be able to meet up within the context of the guidance. So people who've been vaccinated are in a situation now where they can meet up with other vaccinated people from up to two other households. And as your package said, people who are vaccinated will also be in a position to meet up indoors without other restrictions being applied with unvaccinated people, so long as those unvaccinated people are in the low-risk groups. So in the practical example there of those children and grandparents talking about those kinds of opportunities is exactly the kind of thing that can happen.
Are you also concerned, though, about anticipatory behaviour, which we heard a lot about over the last year?
Yes, and we've seen it on many occasions. So where we introduce a change in the measures, and maybe the public might feel that things are getting better and perhaps start to take on activities that are going beyond what we think is appropriate and safe. Indoor activities, parties, get-togethers and other celebrations that we think we're not ready for yet. In general, the population in this country has maintained very close adherence to the measures. That's why we're in the strong situation that we're in at the moment. The disease remains in a well-controlled situation and has done for a number of weeks. And we're watching that very, very closely. We watch all the indicators of behaviour. And the reason that is the case, it isn't because we've gotten to vaccine levels that are yet capable of controlling the disease at a population level. It's because people have kept up a very strong adherence to the measures. So as we roll through vaccination, we need people to keep up that level of close adherence to the measures and not get ahead of where we're recommending.
Chief Medical Officer Tony Houlihan from the News at One with Brian Dobson. Then later, Amy O'Connor got to go to Penny's, and she was reporting on the Ray Darcy Show.
Look, I got up at 7:30. I was in O'Connell Street at 9:00, queuing up bright and early outside.
Right. But you had an appointment made, so why'd you have to queue?
Well, because they were clearing out the store from the 8 a.m. cohort.
Oh, right.
So they had to. So when you rocked up, I was there about 5 or 10 minutes before my shopping slot. And the queue was sort of snaking around the corner. And, you know, at first I was kind of like, well, why should I book an appointment if I have to queue up? But in fairness, that actually moves really, really quickly afterwards. So, yeah.
I love the fact that you referred to the first group as the 8 o'clock cohort.
I know. This is vaccination talk.
Yeah, I know. Yes. We've developed a whole way of talking, a whole new way of talking, haven't we, over the last 14 months? So I believe while you were online trying to get an appointment with Penny's, your parents were online trying to get appointment for a vaccination.
Exactly. Tale of Two Irelands. My parents registering for the vaccine last week and me making sure I could get into Penny's to get me a few bits.
Okay. Now was this as you're in your role as a journalist or in your role as a human being? If you know what
no.
I mean. A bit of both.
It was very much, well, a bit of both, but no, very much in my role as a 28-year-old woman, I think.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Right, okay. I can hear you're still giddy after it.
I swear to God, I was buzzing after it. Like, I went home to my boyfriend after and he was like, you're in a fantastic mood. It was just being out, doing something normal, being with people. It was amazing.
Yeah. So how did it work then? So are you given a time slot? Is it exactly an hour or what? Is it 45 minutes or what?
Yeah, so you kind of have about 45 minutes to do your shopping, and then at about that point, an announcement went out over the speakers, kind of, you know, saying you've got 15 minutes to wrap things up, folks. You know, kind of like the end of the night in a pub, you know. Come on, folks, clear out. So, I mean, basically, it was really well managed. Like, you rocked in, someone checked your confirmation email, cross-referenced it with their things, and then, yeah, like, you had your 45 minutes just to wander around. I'm not sure how many people were in there, like, maybe 100 people, maybe, okay, over kind of three floors in O'Connell Street. So you have a lot of space to wander around,
yes,
you know.
Yeah.
There wasn't any point where I felt like my space was being encroached on or anything like that. And I think everyone was very considerate and respectful of each other as well.
And did you feel, because there was a time put on it, that you were under pressure?
There was definitely a bit of a supermarket sweep kind
was
of
there, yes,
vibe. You're kind of throwing things into the basket, and then, like, I threw a lot of things into the basket early on, and then when I was actually paying for it, cashier was pulling stuff out of it, and I was like, I don't remember putting those crunchies into my basket. When did I put that in? But yeah, there was a bit of, like, don't think, just do it.
Okay.
I think, you know, judging by everyone else's baskets, I think everyone else is in the same kind of frame of mind.
And in your role as a journalist, you're obviously observing other people. What did you notice?
Well, funny enough, one of the things I liked was a lot of people were FaceTiming their friends and relatives and stuff, kind of showing what was available in the shop to them and stuff.
Yeah.
The other funny thing was, I would say it was like 99% women in there. The men's section was absolutely, like, desolate. It was pretty untouched, whereas all the women were, like, you know, at the underwear, pajama section and all that kind of thing. But mostly I just thought there was a real kind of sense of giddiness and excitement in the air. It was really, really palpable, even when you're standing outside. Like, there was an older lady standing behind me, and she was like, I probably don't even really need anything, but it's just a novelty.
That's what I was about to say, actually. There was more to it than just shopping in pennies, wasn't there? Was more significance to it than that?
I think so. I think it was just the first time, you know, you've gotten to do something half normal again.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, like you said, like that woman said, I probably didn't even need a whole lot in pennies for kind of very basic stuff like socks and tights and things like that. But it was just getting to go out. And it's still not business as usual. You're obviously wearing your mask. There's an element of planning involved. It's not like we were all just popping into pennies. Like, we had queued up online to get our appointments last
week. Yes,
but it was just that idea of just being out with people and just doing something really normal that felt like, you know, something I would have been doing last February, say.
Yeah. Can you tell us what you bought?
Oh, what didn't I buy? I think would be easier. I spent 130 euro, which was, you know, this is the curse of pennies. You go in and you say, I'm only going to get a few bits. And then all of a sudden you've spent over 100 quid.
But you get a lot in pennies for 130 euro, in fairness, Amy.
Yeah, I got two pairs of jeans, I got a pair of runners, a lot of socks, a lot of tights, rings, scrunchies, face masks, right, you know, other beauty bits. Like, the list goes on.
Yeah. What are their face masks like?
By face masks, I actually mean the...
Oh, the cosmetic
face
type.
Masks. Yes. Exactly. Yes, glamorous.
Yeah,
the glamorous face masks.
Not the medical ones, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So then you're out, and it's obvious to everybody in the world where you've been, because you have your pennies bag.
Because, yeah, I have an enormous double pennies bag, because obviously I had so much stuff that they needed reinforcement. So they gave, like, it was a bag inside a bag, if you like. But, yeah, I went up to the bar on Tiller Street straight afterwards, and the girl that was serving me noticed my pennies bag. And she was like, oh, my God, you went to pennies. How was it? How do you feel? And then she called over one of her colleagues from the deli counter, and they were both like, tell us everything. We're so happy for you. It was just lovely. Like, just even those kind of interactions, like, yeah. I was buzzing after it.
Amy O'Connor on The Ray Darcy Show. So along with the relief of having your older and more vulnerable loved ones vaccinated and the world becoming a bit more normal, even though the usual restrictions are still in place, for some people getting back to normal is a daunting thing. In the morning, Claire Byrne was talking to Dr. Sabina Brennan about feeling unsure about getting back out there.
I think it's perfectly normal to feel anxious. And I think a lot of people are feeling both excited and anxious. And they're not all that different in a way. You know, the stress response, has a similar sensation, you know, those butterflies in your tummy when it just kicks off. But anxiety is a normal response to stressors. But it's really important to distinguish between anxiety that serves a purpose, such as when it alerts you to danger and helps you to prepare and pay attention, which is what you want to do in this instance, and anxiety that interferes with your ability to function. So it becomes so all-consuming that you almost become frozen and you can't do what it is you want to do. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think there's a few things. Anxiety is very closely linked to our perception of control. So I think there's responsibility here for both the employees and employers if we're talking about work. If you're a little bit concerned about going back to work, write down all your concerns and turn them into questions and send them to your employer. And either the answers will allay your fears, i.e. here's all the steps that are put in place to stop you from, you know, being exposed to the virus, or here's what's going to happen, here's how it's going to work, or else they'll prompt next step actions. You know, if you feel, well, actually, I prefer if you did X, Y, Z, or are you not doing X, Y, Z? So that would help, because uncertainty feeds into that anxiety.
Now, you'll have people listening to that, Sabina, who'll say, now, what will my employer's perception of me be if I'm sending in all of these questions before I go back into the office?
I think he should recognise you as a responsible employee who doesn't want to infect other members of the staff and doesn't want to be infected by other members of the staff. And everybody benefits from that. So you can couch it in that way, you know, very excited to return to work. In the interest that we can stay working, I'd really like to know, you know, what steps are in place. And I think it's important actually to be honest, rather than the onus having to be on the employer. I think, you know, on the employee, rather, I think it would be most beneficial if employers took preemptive steps to allay their employees' fears.
Absolutely.
And actually sent them out messages in advance. Here's what's going to happen. Here's what will, you know, I'd appreciate your input. I think that would be the very mm-hmm. best approach.
And then even before you get into the door to work, there are some people who will have fears around getting back on the bus.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, you know what? And it is very, very normal response, and you manage it steps at a time. I mean, back in the first lockdown, about 6 weeks in, you know, when we really hadn't gone anywhere, you know, and mm-hmm. it was still that very heightened state of fear. We have adapted somewhat, and in some ways that's good for our stress levels. In other ways, as listening to your last interviewee, you know, it can also allow us to drop our guard a little bit. But I mean, I know I had to go down to do on RT the Today Show, which is in Cork, and I was doing something that was relative to, you know, lockdown and social isolation, and so I was given a dispensation to travel. And I remember going into the train station and feeling my panic rising, mm-hmm. you know, and really being afraid when someone else came in the carriage. So that's perfectly normal. It's important to rationalize your fears and to follow, you know, the guidance to the letter of the law. But I would dip in a step at a time. If you are feeling that you might get overwhelmed, a little at a time, and reintroduce as many of your old routines as possible, as they will help you to feel comfortable.
Do we have to trick our brains a little bit to accept new realities? For some people, they might not want to go back to the way things were, and you might have to for economic reasons, yeah. for social reasons and so on. What are the little tricks we can do to sort of instruct our brains to play ball?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are in a hyper, you know, we've been chronically stressed for a very long time. So ordinarily, if you just have, you know, an immediate stress response, your thinking brain will actually override that and allow you to put it in perspective and talk yourself down. Now, at the moment, for a lot of people, their emotional brain, their amygdala, their fear centers is actually shutting down or shouting down their rational brain. So I think that we actually have to take active and be very proactive about, you know, listening to our thinking and changing it up and saying, actually, that's not rational in this mm-hmm. situation. And I think also asking employers, if you are feeling over anxious, can you go back in a stepwise fashion?
Okay,
and you know, where you try a bit at a time.
And Sabina, you have a nice tip, which you're going to tell us about just before we finish, about creating a laughter stash.
Oh, I do. This is my tip for, look, laughter is nature's natural stress buster. It actually lowers cortisol levels. And I think a lot of people have forgotten to have fun. And so what I suggest is create a laughter stash, whatever takes your fancy, whether it's funny memes, funny baby videos, whatever. And when you feel panic rising, go to that. Go straight mm-hmm. to that so you can actually start to laugh. And don't forget to smile. that also reduces stress levels and releases serotonin and you know, will help you to feel more comfortable. And they're tools that we do have control over.
Dr. Sabina Brennan from Today with Claire Byrne. And on the Ryan Tuberty Show, Amanda Larkin is a woman on a mission with her project called Little Dolls of Love.
We are definitely on a mission.
Okay, well, let's start at the beginning then. You want to collect 796 dolls for a very profound reason. Tell me about that.
That's correct, Ryan. So we're doing a Little Doll of Love. So we're looking to collect 796 dolls, and what we want to do is we want to do an image that represents the 796 babies missing in Tuam, believed to be in the septic tank.
Okay, and tell me about the image you're trying to create and how you're going to do it.
So the image we're trying to create, what we want to do is we have a location selected in Mayo. Mm-hmm. And we just want to lay the dolls out very, very simply, just 796, just to show the image of the amount of babies we're talking about.
This might sound like an odd question, but is there a particular type of doll you want?
So there is.
Yeah.
So what we'd be hoping for would be a baby-born doll, Ryan.
I understand the one you're talking about, yeah.
So the ones that are baby size, I suppose.
Mm. It that is a very striking image, isn't it? If you get 796 dolls, like almost a real life childlike size dolls in a field. Mm-hmm. Before we get to the whys and the wheres of it, how are you going to achieve this in terms of collecting the dolls and getting them? And what are you looking for today?
Oh, so what we're looking for today is dolls. We're looking for dolls to come in. We have collection points set up ourselves. There's a team of four of us that are running this.
Okay.
So there are four women running this. So at the moment, we have about 350 dolls in at the moment, Ryan. So we're still looking for more dolls to come in. They're coming in from all over Ireland to us at the moment, Ryan. They're coming in from England. They're coming. We have people contacting us who wishes to buy dolls and have them delivered to us. So today we're just looking for more support. We're just looking for more dolls. If people wish to do collection points, or if people can bring dolls from all over Ireland to us, whatever help is out there, we'll take it.
Okay.
No matter how small, or no matter if people can't help with getting a doll, with transport, you know, share it on Facebook, tell a friend.
Okay, you're just shy of about 400 dolls now to complete your project. And for example, Catherine Corliss, this is really the person who brought this story to the world. Is she volunteered to help out in any way?
Absolutely. So Catherine has actually made dolls from scratch for us, Ryan.
Oh.
So Catherine has made dolls. She's made about, I think, 15 dolls from scratch for us for this display.
Out of what?
So out of the faces, I know that she's made them out of clay and stuff like that. We have it on our event page. We have an event page, Little Doll of Love.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the photos, some of the photos up there of the dolls that have come in so far and different things like that. So we're trying to track it, because almost every doll that comes in, Ryan, there's a story behind it, or there's a reason that somebody has put the doll in. And we could write a book at this stage about the 350 dolls that have come in so far.
Oh, I bet. And when you have the 796 dolls, you're going to a field in, is it Castlebar, somewhere near there?
We're going to a selected area in Castlebar, that's right, yeah.
And you'll place them in a row, or have you planned that out yet?
Yeah, we have plans made, but everything is subject to change on the day, Ryan, how it'll look and stuff. But we do have an idea in our head, but we think we'll get a selection of images from that. Because of COVID and restrictions, we don't want to organise anything in case the restrictions have changed. So we've done it to level 5. There's 10 of us there on the day, and it'll be put out on social media, the video and the images afterwards.
What do you want people to take from the visual of these nearly 800 dolls on a field?
The amount, Ryan.
Yeah.
The amount. 796 is a number that rolls off people's tongue too easily. Each one of these are babies. Each one of these are innocent little souls that didn't get a voice, Ryan.
And Amanda spoke about her mother Carmel's experience.
Yeah, so my mum was born in the two mother and baby home in 1949. And she spent 5.5 of her years in the two mother and baby home before she was boarded at Tamayo.
What did she, I mean, she's very young. Was she able to tell you anything about her experience in the home?
In the two mother and baby home, I suppose for a lot of survivors, she would have flashes. She would have certain images that she can remember or certain names that she would remember. But her memories would be more from when she came out of the home, the different things that she experienced, animals, people, that's what she would remember more than actual experiences of the mother and baby institution.
How long did it take for her to find out? In other words, what age was she when she found out who her mother was?
Mom was 70 years of age. We only found out 18 months ago, Ryan, who Carmel's mother was.
And can you share any details with me?
Yeah, so Carmel's mother, from the information that we were given 18 months ago, she would have been 38 years old when she got pregnant. She would have been living with her mother in Ballina. Mm-hmm. So at 38, she was coerced into the two mother and baby home. She spent 9 months in there, and then she would have been trafficked from the two mother and baby home down to the psychiatric unit in Castlebar, which would have been the mental hospital at the time. She's believed to have spent 12 years of her life there, Ryan, and she passed away. And because there is no record of family contact or any contact with her for the 12 years, she was then buried in a mass grave in Castlebar.
God, it's like something out of the Dark Ages, isn't it? Still,
yeah.
After all these years. And
I think for that, Ryan, the most hurtful thing for Mum, because I was with her when the social workers broke that news to her 18 months ago in Castlebar in the Poosla offices. And I think for Mum, for her, the biggest hurt and the biggest upset for her is that she will never know what her mother looked like. She will never have a photograph of her mother. She will never know what her own mother looked like.
Did she take any comfort, cold as it was, in finding any details at all, or was it too late, too little, too late?
She had struggled for so long to get the details. Poosla had closed her file, Ryan, with a couple of years that there was no information there. And then suddenly, out of the blue, this came. It was the manner in which it came, Ryan, that was just, it was so unbelievably hurtful at the time.
You know, I was watching Reeling in the Ears last week, and they were showing some of the women who had been in different homes coming out of the Dáil. I'd forgotten how emotional it was, how these people of a certain age who should have been given so much more respect and dignity, you know, just standing at the gate crying like children. And I suppose your mum is one of those women in some ways.
We're still standing at the gates and we're still begging like children. We're begging for 976 babies to be taken out of a septic tank in June. They're still begging for closure. That's what they're looking for, Ryan.
Well, tell me about that. The 796 babies. Where are we on the exhumation? It feels like we've been talking about this for a long time. And I know Catherine Corliss always says, you know, look, it's great that we've heard this bit of good news today, but we still haven't got the proper answer. So where is it at? Right.
So it's in the Oireachtas. So Catherine was in the Oireachtas a couple of weeks ago where the bill was being debated. I was in the Oireachtas a couple of weeks ago as a member of the collaborative forum where it's being debated. So it's with the Oireachtas at the moment. It has to come to the Dáil. We're hoping it'll come this month to the Dáil. And then it has to pass and be signed into legislation. So,
and is that for exhumation?
That's for the burials bill.
The burials bill, and that will allow for an exhuming of the bodies.
Yeah, excavation of the bodies, yeah.
And
but the earliest we'll be looking is next year, I think, if everything goes according to plan. Okay. But at the moment, we're experiencing delays even with the living witnesses redress. So
the fight goes on.
for the survivors, the delay was the commission's report. They waited and waited years and years for the commission report. So the delay that we're experiencing right now, we're unsure what's causing that delay.
Okay.
We're unsure...
Maybe somebody might explain that to us. Wouldn't that be handy?
It would be lovely to have some direct communication from the department, from the Mother and Baby Home Department. I asked for it last week, Ryan.
Yeah.
Just to explain to us why the delay is going on, just to have a little bit of respect for the living witnesses, for the survivors.
That wouldn't take much more than two paragraphs to say, listen, sorry about this, here's the following. This is what's happening. Which ministry does that fall under? Is it the
Minister O'Gorman?
So Minister for Children, Roderick O'Gorman. So he really needs to get his people on that to issue even a couple of paragraphs to say, look, we're out the door here, we're up to our ears, but we are close, and we're, you know, something reassuring.
Just update.
Okay, that's
all
what you need.
We're asking for. That's Minister Sapone, really set the tone with us, nothing for us without us. That was the motto that was done. We're 2 weeks late. We've had no information from the government. And I suppose... we thought last year when the burials bill was going through and stuff like that, oh my God, is this the last year we're doing a Vincent tomb? Is this the last year we have to remind the government we're here? And we're now looking at it going, oh my God, we're here again, and now we've to lay 796 dolls out to show the world, to show Ireland, this is the amount of babies that is believed to be lying there. This is the amount of Irish citizens who didn't get a voice, didn't get justice, didn't get anything.
When that picture comes out of the 796 dolls on a number of fields, whatever it might be, that picture will go around the world, and that picture will be shameful, and we have plenty to be ashamed of, let's face it. But that's the impact you hope to have, I presume, just to shame people into action.
It's a horrible thing, Ryan, but yeah, it's a horrible thing that we have to do that. It's a horrible thing that this amount of years on, after the story broke, after everything, that we're still in a position where we have to shame the Irish government into doing it.
Amanda Larkin from The Ryan Tuberty Show. And with more on the vaccine rollout, Claire Byrne was talking to Christine Loescher, Professor of Immunology at DCU.
Now, around 200,000 people aged 45 to 49 could be fully vaccinated against COVID-19 next month if the HSE is given permission to change restrictions around the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. The HSE is believed to be asking if this age restriction around the one-shot vaccine can be lowered from 50, as it currently is, to 45. And I'm joined now by Professor of Immunology at DCU, Christine Loescher. Good morning to you.
Morning, Claire.
Thank you very much for joining us. So this would mean that 200,000 doses of the one-shot jab, which might end up surplus and not being used under the existing age limit, could be administered to people between the ages of 45 and 49. What do you think of this idea?
I think it's a great idea. I think it's showing that, you know, the institutions that we're working with, the HSE, NIAC, the government, everyone is responding all the time to the changes that are happening. So not just the science, but also the supply. So if you remember when we spoke last week, we talked about other age groups having access to vaccines. And, you know, the clever thing to do is to look at how many vaccines we have and who's the most suitable people to give them to. And, you know, when you look at the science and the data, there's very little that really distinguishes between 45 to 49 year olds and the 50 to 59 year old cohort when it comes to Johnson & Johnson.
Yeah,
in fact, any of the data, and most of it's come out of the US where they predominantly use Johnson & Johnson from the very start, and they've probably given over 10 million doses by the end of April. Most of the data showed that actually those in their 30s in that kind of cohort were probably most at risk, because they have very little data, because probably only about 15 people had an adverse blood clot event at that stage, and that was after about 10 million vaccines.
Professor Christine Loescher from Today with Claire Byrne. And on the live line, Katie Hannan was in for Joe, and the subject that dominated the programme from last Wednesday continued today. Here's Jane's story about her menopause.
I'm 54 years old now. Obviously, my story dates back to about 11 years ago. It started since about I was 41 to 44. I started to feel a little bit not myself. I had the old hot flush every now and again. And then I felt a little bit of brain fog one day, and I had a day I was feeling very depressed. But it wasn't all of the time, and I wasn't really paying that much attention. But I think the big, when my whole life crashed, really was around May, June 2010, which is when I really, really started to feel really, really bad, depressed and tearful, angry. I put on a lot of weight as well. And night sweat. Sorry, Katie.
I was going to say, you were quite young to be experience those symptoms. Did you put it down to, were you, you know, familiar with perimenopause and what those symptoms might be?
Yeah, I kind of thought it could be perimenopause, but I didn't really give a second thought because it wasn't constant before, like I say, April or May 2010. I didn't really think much of it at the time. But then it got much worse, which is when I started having the day and night sweats. And I just started to hate everything and being miserable for no reason. With my husband, obviously, I made his life miserable as well. And I was miserable myself, bottom line. And it was just a really, really tough time for me. And I'm sure it was for him. And I'm sure it was for many people who knew me, my friends, my family and everyone. At work as well, I couldn't concentrate. I started sweating. I had brain fog of forgetting things when I always did a great job before. So I really, really struggled at the time.
How did your boss at work respond to that? Was there support there?
Well, to be honest with you, I didn't even know I was going through the perimenopause. He was my boss at the time, and he did say, well, get your act together. What's wrong with you? You've always done a great job. What's wrong with you? And he was right. He was just doing his job. But I just didn't know what was happening to me. And I think my mistake was, rather than not going then in May, because I eventually went to my fantastic GP, who straight away did an FSH test, and did a thyroid test, well, just in case it was something related to my thyroid. And then she obviously diagnosed that I was going through the perimenopause due to the FSH test results. And she advised the HRT at the time. But that happened 5 months later, when I've already kind of ruined the relationship with my husband pretty much.
And did it really ruin your relationship? You really believe that your mood swings were what ruined that relationship?
I really think so, Katie, because before that, I adored the man. He is a fantastic person and he's a fantastic husband. We were together for 18 years before that happened. Of course, no relationship is blissful forever. You do argue every now and again, but not to the extent of that hatred about him and about everything else, you know. So, yeah, the answer to your question, Katie, it probably is yes, definitely. Had I taken the HRT before, I probably would be still with him.
Wow. And how long is it since you separated?
Yeah, we separated. I moved out of the marital home in November 2010.
And did you go on and get divorced?
Eventually I left the country. I moved to England, but we divorced in 2012.
Well, that's Jane. Then Dawn told her story.
Oh, my story. I'm 42 now. And I suppose when I was 28, 29, I suppose, like the previous lady, noticed a change in my mood. Obviously, 28, 29, you just put it down to your hormones. But then I started to get hot flushes. Like, I could actually see myself getting red I could see it rising in me from my chest up to my neck. This would happen kind of during the day and during the night. Myself and my partner had talked about starting a family. And obviously we started trying. Things weren't happening. So
went to my doctor. She, you know, did all the usual checks and everything else. No reason why you can't have a family. So continue to try. After about 12 months then, we decided that we'd go to a consultant in Dublin. And he ran various tests and said, no reason why either of you can't get pregnant. You're both perfectly healthy. He gave me a prescription for Clomid, I think it was called, and said to come back in 6 weeks. Came back in 6 weeks, did some more tests. Nope, still nothing happening. Keep trying. At this stage, we were handing out hundreds of euro every time we saw the consultant. And I think after about 4 or 5 trips, I remember coming home in the car and I said to him, I can't do this anymore. I physically can't put myself through this every single time we go up, thinking he's going to say, right, this is what's happening, so we need to do this. There never seemed to be a solution. It was always just, stay going.
And
stay
what,
going.
Was there a discussion about you possibly
never.
Being... Never.
Never.
It was never mentioned.
Never, ever. I suppose because of my age, they never considered that this might be the problem.
But
you
had had an illness earlier, had you not,
yeah,
that may have contributed?
Yeah. I had skin cancer in 2005. And I would have been on an interferon treatment for about 12 months. But again, it was never looked at as maybe an issue that might affect my fertility.
When did you finally get to hear what might be going on?
Got to the stage where I was talking to my mum about it, and she had a neighbour, and this lady had attended a clinic in Cork, a fertility clinic in Cork, and she couldn't speak highly enough of them. So I rang and I made an appointment, and they did blood tests and they did scans, and within an hour of doing the tests and the scans, they told me I was perimenopausal. One appointment.
That's simple.
And I was coming home in the car and it was kind of like, right, I'm relieved in a sense. I know what the problem is. But in another sense, I can't have children now. You know, so it really kind of brought home a lot of realities. And I think I cried the whole way home from Cork that day. But it was like, right, okay, at least I know. I know what's wrong. I know what's been happening to me. Do you know that sort of a way? So...
But the good news is you did, and you do have,
yes,
children.
The good news is we saved away and we said we'd try IVF. We'd give it one go and see what happened. So we attended the Sims Clinic in Clonskee in Dublin, and we had egg donation, and I conceived twins, one boy and one girl. Yeah. There were 4 in December gone, and they're just 2 little miracles.
Well, that's Dawn. And Anne also called Katie after crying in relief after hearing other women's menopause stories.
Yeah, I was on my way shopping last week and I was listening to the girls telling their stories, and I was like every one of them, I kept saying to myself, that's me. That's exactly what I'm going through. And every one of them was like, listening to a mirror of myself, because all their symptoms was exactly what I was going through. So I ended up having to pull the car over because I got so upset. Like, I was overwhelmed. And I remember one of the girls mentioned the Facebook page. So what I did when I composed myself, I went onto the Facebook page, the Irish Menopause page, and I sought some advice from a couple of the girls on there, because basically my story is in my late 30s, I had to have a hysterectomy because we had 13 miscarriages. And
sorry, Anne. 13 miscarriages.
Yeah, we had 13 miscarriages. Sorry, I'm going to get upset now. We had 2 perfectly healthy children, and then we wanted to expand our family. And I had 13 miscarriages. So after having a lot of meetings with my gynae, because of having so many miscarriages and all the D&Cs, my womb and cervix was just in bits, basically. So she had recommended then that I had to have a hysterectomy. So I was in my late 30s and had the hysterectomy. And then about 6 months afterwards, I was put on HRT because I was starting to get flushes. And I was on HRT up until about 2 years ago. I'm 52 now.
So up until about 2 years ago, I had to go to my GP to get my prescription renewed. And the day I went in, there was a locum on. So she just sat me down and she asked me what I wanted to get. So I told her I needed to get my HRT prescription renewed. And she looked at the screen and she just said, "What? You're on HRT 12 years. And I said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, that has to stop today. You're not. I'm not renewing your prescription." And I just was, I don't know, I presume because she was the doctor, I should have taken her advice. And I kind of felt a little bit intimidated as well because she scared me a lot with cancer stories, you know, the risk of getting cancer from being on HRT and the fact that I was on it for 12 years, I was at a higher risk. So she said, as and from today, I'm not renewing your prescription for HRT. So anyway, I came out of the surgery, came home. And then I was worried that, I was going to get cancer because I was on it for the 12 years. And
how long ago was that, Anne?
Almost 2 years ago, she took me off it.
Right. And you must have been worried, though, because you knew what it felt like when you weren't on HRT. Were you worried about the consequences or the symptoms?
Yeah, I was really worried because initially when I had the hysterectomy, I kind of had a few of the symptoms, but was put on HRT. And I was worried then the fact that I was so much older now, the fact that I was 50 at the time. But I just trusted her because I felt she was a doctor. She knew what she was talking about. So I was kind of like, okay, well, I'll go with it because she's told me this. And then I was absolutely terrified I was going to get cancer. So basically within 3-4 days of being off the HRT, I cannot express this enough. It was literally like somebody hit me with a train. My whole body, my life was crumbling down around me. Initially it was the hot flushes, the insomnia, the tiredness.
So take us back to Wednesday. You're in the car. You've Googled the Facebook page. Made contact with others. What did you do then?
So then I just got so upset. When I came home again from shopping, I got upset again because somebody had advised me to ring my GP again. And I was like, "But sure, they've taken me off." And in my head, I was saying, "They've taken me off, but she's going to tell me no." And anyway, I rang my GP and I got a consultation for a couple of hours later and she rang me back and I just started crying. I said, "I can't continue the way I'm going." I said, "I really feel so unhappy. I'm so tired." And I told her all this. And I said, "Is there no way I can go back onto HRT?" And she said, "But who took you off the HRT?" And I said, "I'm off the HRT nearly 2 years now because I went in to get renewed a couple of years ago and the locum wouldn't put me back on it. She told me I wasn't allowed to be on it. I was on it too long." And she said, my GP said, "Well, what was her reason for that?" And I said, "I don't know. She just told me I was on it far too long." She said, "But Anne, you can be on it." And then I just burst out crying again. And I said, "I really can go back and hit your teeth." She said, "Yeah, of course you can. Your body needs this estrogen." So basically, that was it. Then she said, "Look, I'm going to do a prescription for you and I'm going to email it to your local chemist." She said, "And start on them." And she said, "Stay in contact with me. Let me know how you feel. And if you feel they're working," she said, "we can go up a dose, you know, we make a higher dose." So basically, my advice is to any woman, listen to your body. Nobody has to go through this.
That's Anne on the Live Line with Katie Hannan. And that's it for Playback Daily. So mind yourself till next time.